Let's turn to the book of Psalms, to Psalm 44. Psalm 44. We'll read from verse 1. We have heard with our ears, O God. Our fathers have told us what work thou didst in their days, in the times of old. How thou didst drive out the heathen with thy hand and plantedest them. How thou didst afflict the people and cast them out. For they got not the land in possession by their own sword, neither did their own arm save them. But thy right hand and thine arm and the light of thy countenance, because thou hadst a favour unto them. Thou art my king, O God. Command deliverances for Jacob. Through thee will we push down our enemies. Through thy name will we tread them under that rise up against us. For I will not trust in my bow, neither shall my sword save me. But thou hast saved us from our enemies, and hast put them to shame that hated us. In God we boast all the day long, and praise thy name forever. Selah. Amen. And may the Lord bless the reading of his word. What I have to say tonight, I want to say in the context of verse 1 of this psalm. It says there, we have heard with our ears, O God. Our fathers have told us what work thou didst in their days, in the times of old. Obviously here the reference is to the history of Israel and the things that the Lord had done for his people in a bygone day. And here the psalmist speaks about the rehearsal of those things, the mighty acts of God that the Lord wrought. And he says, quite simply, we've heard about these things with our ears. Our fathers have told us. We weren't there to see it. We were not alive at the time. But they were able to tell us about what they experienced of God's hand in their day. And really, when we talk about revival, it's often like that. You read church history books, you read the accounts of revival that have taken place, and you could use this text to really overshadow all of that, to be like an umbrella over all of that, and just say, we've heard with our ears, or at least we've read with our eyes in our history books, our fathers have told us what work the Lord did in their days in the times of old. And it is thrilling to read about bygone days of church history when the Lord moved in awakenings, in revival. I've been reading recently about the Great Awakening, which is often referred to as the First Great Awakening, in the 1730s and the 1740s here in America, chiefly but not exclusively in New England. The Great Awakening, it's often called by historians the First Great Awakening, was an evangelical movement that swept this country. It was part of a much broader revival movement, however, across the seas. There was an evangelical upsurge, you might call it, taking place simultaneously on the other side of the Atlantic, most notably in England, in Scotland, and even over in continental Europe, in Germany. The awakening impacted the American colonies, particularly New England, places like Massachusetts, in the 1730s and the 1740s, and the move of God at that particular time left a permanent impact upon American Protestantism. A contemporary historian described the awakening in this way. The First Great Awakening in America resulted in a quantum leap forward in the life of the church and the nation. It was a psychological earthquake which reshaped the religious, social, and moral landscape of colonial America and determined its destiny for the next two centuries. The results that were seen here in America were staggering. It's estimated, and you've always got to take estimates for what they're worth. No one actually sat down and counted every last convert, and if they did, they still wouldn't be able to do so infallibly, because the Lord knoweth them that are his. But it is estimated that by means of the Great Awakening, something like 50,000 souls were added to the churches of New England. Now that's incredible when you think of it, that kind of number. You can imagine a football stadium or a baseball stadium full of people, 50,000 people converted to God. And remember, this was way back in the 18th century. The population was not as large as it is today. So at that particular time, the total population of that area was about 250,000. So out of 250,000 souls, some 50,000 were added to the churches. And that was not the extent of the work that God did, because in the middle states, the Spirit of God was working. And the revival ultimately affected over 100 different towns. Hundreds of new churches were planted. The ranks of serving ministers swelled. The Lord was calling men into the pastorate. Bible-based schools and colleges multiplied. Works of love and mercy abounded, and missionary impetus transported the message of the gospel to many other nations. Revival had come. When we speak about an awakening, it's something that, again, we emphasize God must do. Revival is the work of God. That's true revival, not just something that's claimed to be a revival, but a true work that is done in the hearts of men that results in transformed lives and homes and communities. This is the work of God. And you'll remember the verse that we studied, "Not by might nor by power, but by my Spirit, saith the Lord of hosts." Anything that's by human might or power is not going to stand the test, but that which is the work of the Spirit of God will last. And the first great awakening was a lasting work that God did. We've heard with our ears, O God. Our fathers have told us what work thou didst in their days, in the times of old. And surely we would want to see a visitation of God such as in the old days here in America. I want to say several things about this first great awakening as we come to pray tonight. First of all, I want us to think about the period in which it was experienced. The period in which it was experienced, it was a time when there had been great declension. The great awakening of 1735 to 45 was actually a reaction to a decline in holiness and a laxity of morals within the congregational churches of New England. Now, we have to depend on some of the writers at the time to tell us the information that forms the backcloth to this. There was one writer who observed the decline in piety among the second generation of Puritans, which stemmed from economic changes, political transformations, and Enlightenment rationalism, was the primary cause of the Great Awakening. During the 18th century, political uncertainty and economic instability characterized colonial life and diverted devout Puritans from religious obligations. So basically, you could just cover all that with one sentence. There was a spirit of backsliding among the successors to the Puritans. Those men and women who came, who had the first Thanksgiving and all of that, we've read about those times, their successors got sidetracked. And in addition to some of the secular causes of the decline, as they've been identified, there was compromise within the congregational church that contributed to the weakening of religious commitment. The second and third generations of Puritans failed to demonstrate the same devotion and discipline that the original Puritans had practiced. It is an interesting fact that in the days of Joshua, in the days of the judges, there was a decline among the people, and the Lord actually identified this decline by saying this, Judges chapter 2 verse 10, and also all that generation were gathered unto their fathers, and there arose another generation after them which knew not the Lord, nor yet the works which he had done for Israel. That's always a sad thing when your progeny, when your children or your grandchildren don't follow along the same line that you have followed when you've been following the Lord. And people sometimes will speak to me about that and lament the fact that their children are not interested in the things of God, that their children don't go to church. They were brought up in Sunday school, they were brought up in the things of God, but they've no interest in the things of the Lord. But this is nothing new. There arose another generation after them which knew not the Lord, nor yet the works which he had done for Israel. Salvation doesn't run in the blood. Children need to have an experience of God for themselves. And I thank God for my godly parents, but I'm not saved, strictly speaking, because of them, though I believe the Lord brought me to himself through their influence. But I had to come to know the Savior myself. I had to come to see these things, so that when they were not around, I would still be following these things. Well, in the times that I'm speaking about here, there were people who didn't demonstrate the same devotion that their parents and their grandparents and so on had shown. Now, to compensate for a decline in piety that began as early as the mid-17th century, and to ensure a steady growth in their congregations, the Congregational Churches of Connecticut and Massachusetts adopted what was called the Halfway Covenant for Church Membership. That was done in 1662. See, prior to this time, membership in the church required regeneration. You had to be born again. And you had to be able to give a credible testimony of a specific conversion experience. You had to be able to tell how the Lord saved you, when and where you came to know the Lord. Now, I know that sometimes people can express their conversion, their testimony, in a way which doesn't identify date, time, and place. And that's fine, as long as there was a time, as long as there was that experience that you had. You don't have to necessarily be able to pluck that out of there and say, well, it was the 26th of January, 19, whatever. Because I personally can't do that. I know, I believe I came to know the Lord in childhood, but I can't tell you exactly what the date was. But I know that there was that experience. Now, when the Halfway Covenant was brought in, it involved the congregational churches really compromising to get members. As politics and economics superseded religion, this second generation of Puritans failed to emphasize in the same way the need for conversion to Christ. And so this Halfway Covenant furthered the degeneration of the churches, as those churches became inhabited largely by people without a personal relationship with God. So the churches were full of people who were unsaved, basically. And sadly, even many of the ministers didn't know Christ. And therefore, they could not lead their flocks to the true shepherd, having not been led to him themselves. There was a preacher of that time, John Whiting of Hartford, I guess in Connecticut. He expressed the need for revival in a sermon in 1686, saying, quote, "Is there not too visible and general a declension? Are we not turned, and that quickly too, out of the way wherein our fathers walked? a rain of righteousness and soaking showers of converting, sanctifying grace sent from heaven will do the business for us and indeed nothing else. Unquote. And that man recognized the need for God to work. Now, prior to the revival times, a spiritual dryness had set in, even among true Christians. Religion had become something of a pastime, in which a lot of people would just sort of go through the motions during religious services without any deeply felt conviction of soul. It was only after decades of such complacency that the spiritual revival of the Great Awakening came about, and suddenly the Spirit of God awoke as if from a great slumber and began to touch the population. This was the period that we're talking about in which the awakening was experienced. But there's something else here, and that is the prayer by which it was energized. I've said before in this series that there's never been a revival that has not had some impetus involved with it that was prayerful. There was a lot of prayer that gave force and energy to the revival. The prayers of godly men was the foundation under God of the great evangelical awakening, the first awakening. Jonathan Edwards said, "Prayer is as natural an expression of faith as breathing is of life." Jonathan Edwards was himself a man of prayer, and he sought to see the apathy and the lukewarmness purged from his people in his church, and thus he began to pray and fast for an entire week, and it was then that the Lord gave him that message to preach, that famous message entitled "Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God." It's reported that before a preaching meeting, George Whitefield, another famous revival preacher, he would spend hours, sometimes all night, bathing an event in prayer, bringing it before the Lord, praying for God to work. And fervent church members, even though sometimes in small numbers, kept the fires of revival going through their genuine petitions for God's intervention in the lives of their communities. Some of that praying was offered even by the young people in their own meetings. At one point, Jonathan Edwards wrote, and this is to do with Northampton, I believe, up in Massachusetts, quote, "The children in various parts of the town had religious meetings by themselves for prayer, sometimes joined with fasting, wherein many of them seemed to be greatly and properly affected." The prayer by which it was energized. May the Lord give to his people today, all over this land and all over this world indeed, a spirit of prayer to seek him. As well as the prayer by which the awakening was energized, we could talk about the personalities by whom it was extended. I'm always hesitant to talk about the personalities of revival because you can tend to think really highly of men rather than of the Lord. But the fact of the matter is that God uses men. And it's believed that among the personalities by whom this revival was extended in the 1730s and 40s, the revival began with Theodor Frelinghuysen, who was a Dutch Reformed Pietist. And it was spread to the Scots-Irish Presbyterians under the ministry of one Gilbert Tennant, who was one of four brothers, the so-called Flaming Tennants. Their father, William Tennant, founded the famous Log College. There's a place down there, still in the Pennsylvania side, called Neshaminy, beside Neshaminy Creek. And I believe there's a marker there that shows the place where the famous Log College existed. It was actually a seminary to train clergymen whose fervent and heartfelt preaching would bring sinners to experience true evangelical conversion. That seminary later became Princeton University. I'm sure you've heard of it. Princeton is a center of unbelief today, but it was once a place where revival fires burned And actually, if you visit a graveyard that's not so very far from Princeton University today, President Edwards, Jonathan Edwards, is buried in that graveyard, and other mighty men of God. The revival fire then spread among the Baptists of Pennsylvania and Virginia before that extraordinary awakening that began in Northampton, Massachusetts, under the ministry of Edwards in December 1734. In the years 1735 to 37, a revival swept through Northampton. And concerning that revival, Edwards wrote, quote, "A great and earnest concern about the great things of religion and eternal world became universal in all parts of the town. The work of conversion was carried on in a most astonishing manner and increased more and more. Souls did, as it were, by flocks come to Jesus Christ," unquote. Wouldn't that be great to see? Not just one or two people getting converted, though that would be wonderful. If somebody said to me, "Brother, for the next year of your ministry, you're going to have one soul get saved every Sunday night," I'd be ecstatic. But when these revival times came, people were being saved by the scores, by the tens. We can't imagine it, but yet God is able to do it. And the first great awakening also, by the way, gained impetus from the itinerant ministry of the famous English Calvinistic Methodist evangelist George Whitefield. God used him in a powerful way. I know that God would raise up men today to preach his word and see revival. And there's one other thought that I want to mention here before we come to pray. And it is the power by which this revival was evidenced. The power by which it was evidenced. And we've hinted at it already. We've mentioned a little bit. The results of a genuine move of God's Spirit have always been clear to see, both in the church itself and then in society at large. It affects both. It will affect the Lord's people and it will affect the ungodly out there. Now, if we think about Northampton in Massachusetts, it was said by people at the time that overnight that town was transformed. Its citizens were beginning to sing hymns in the streets. Can you imagine? People walking along the street singing hymns. The local tavern closed. That's interesting. And I could speak of other revivals where similar things happened. The young people pursued God in large numbers. And furthermore, it was impossible to get into church for worship unless one arrived hours early. This was a move of God. In the year 1740, like a great flash flood, the Great Awakening rolled through New England. And it was at that time that Edwards preached that famous sermon I referenced earlier, "Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God." He preached in the town of Enfield with remarkable results. It's estimated that 10% of New England was converted during that time. Think of that. Somebody put it into perspective by referencing modern America. Imagine today 28 million souls converted in a 2-year period. 28 million conversions within 24 months. Picture every church in your town where you live either doubling or tripling in number in the next 2 years. And you have some grasp of the enormity of what happened at that time. Our fathers have told us the things that God did. What work thou didst in their days, to use the scriptural phrase, in the times of old. In 1743, Jonathan Edwards wrote this: "Ever since the great work of God that was wrought here about 9 years ago, there has been a great abiding alteration in this town in many respects. There has been vastly more religion kept up in the town among all sorts of persons in religious exercises and in common conversation than used to be before. There has remained a more general seriousness and decency in attending the public worship. There has been a very great alteration among the youth of the town with respect to reveling, frolicking, profane and unclean conversation, and lewd songs. Instances of fornication have been very rare. There has also been a great alteration among both old and young with respect to tavern haunting. That means going to taverns and hanging out there. I suppose the town has been in no measure so free of vice in these respects for any long time together for this 60 years as it has been this 9 years past. Unquote. So there were lasting results from the awakening. God did a genuine work. Now, we should add here that as with any true work of God, some of the manifestations that were seen in that awakening were from God, some, however, were from the flesh, and you probably would have to say that some were even of Satan. Because anything that God does, the devil tries to mock it, the devil tries to destroy it, the devil tries to hijack it. I remember reading about the 59 revival in Ulster, and there were things that happened at that time that brought a lot of reproach upon the gospel. Some of the wild excesses that were seen among people, and I'll not go into all the things that happened, but there were various phenomena that took place, and people were thinking, well, this is not of God, and it wasn't. It was animal excitement. And any time you get a genuine move of God, you will get some spurious mixture thrown in. But the proof of the pudding is in the eating, and of course, something that continues is something that is of God. Something that lasts is something that is of God. And just speaking about the spurious elements attached to the First Great Awakening, it not only drew much criticism at the time, but subsequently. There are some who actually wrote against the First Great Awakening, said it wasn't of God because of some of the things that were associated with it. But Jonathan Edwards, who was there, and I think ought to know, he believed that the essential work, the main work that was done at that time, was of God, though he recognized that the entire work would be discredited and abandoned unless the church learned to separate the wheat from the chaff. And so he wrote actually prolifically to that end, his most important work on the subject being On Religious Affections. And that's a Christian classic book that's still in print today. God is able to revive his work even today. It would be a wonderful thing if we were not just having to rely on what our ears have heard, what our fathers have told us, what we've read in church history books and accounts of the time about the work that God did. It would be wonderful. It would be a blessing to see it in our day. Is God able to do that? Yes, he is. Is the Lord able to save large numbers of people today? Why not? What is there to hinder God from doing that? What is there to stop us praying as the psalmist did in a verse that we studied a few weeks ago in Psalm 85 and verse 6, Wilt thou not revive us again, that thy people may rejoice in thee? And the following verse is relevant too. Show us thy mercy, O Lord, and grant us thy salvation. May God send us revival. We sometimes sing it, and we should mean it. Lord, send us revival. Let it begin now in me, gladly dethroning each rival. Yield I my heart unto thee. Amen.